Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
You know, sometimes we read a little verse like that from the Bible and we trip over and we don't even think about it. Ladies and gentlemen, God, the one who reigns in the heavens, the one who created the heavens and the earth with the word of his mouth, the one who rules and disposes the events of mankind, the one who gave his only son to die on our behalf, that God spoke from heaven. And if God speaks, don't you think you and I should listen?
God spoke quite forcefully in the Bible. We see evidence of him addressing people throughout the passages we study. Does God still speak today? He does. In today's message, Pastor David reminds us that God wants to speak to us, and he has so much to say. It may not be as forceful and audible as in biblical times, but that doesn't mean that it's any less important. We should always keep our hearts open to listen for God's voice and for the message he desires to give us. Now, let's join Pastor David with today's study.
Well, as we come to Exodus chapter 20, we come to one of the most important and memorable sections, not only of the book of Exodus, but of the entire Old Testament, and I'll go even further, the entire Bible. Because what we begin with here this morning are what we call the Ten Commandments. And I would imagine that many, many people in this world, people that you meet, people that you work with, people that you go to school with, even if they couldn't name for you five of the Ten Commandments, they know that they exist. They know that they're out there somewhere. And so it's a very important thing for us to sort of take some time, take a look at these Ten Commandments. But I think it's absolutely essential to understand. Before you can understand what the Ten Commandments are, you have to remind yourself about the setting in which they were given. The children of Israel, hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps numbering 2 or 3 million, they came out of Egypt with a mighty hand. God showed his strength, his power, his glory by freeing them from the dominion of Egypt, bringing them through the Red Sea and providing their needs day in and day out there in the wilderness. But as they were led every day by the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day, that guidance eventually brought them to Mount Sinai. And there, camped out at the base of Mount Sinai, God commanded them to set up barriers so they couldn't get very close, because God was going to reveal himself in a powerful way there upon the mountain. And he did. He revealed himself in power. He revealed himself in majesty. We saw it all last week, how when God came and revealed himself, there was thunder, there was lightning, there was fire all over the mountain. There was a thick cloud of smoke and glory. We saw how there was earthquakes underneath their feet. We saw how it would have been overwhelming to them visually and spiritually, especially when they heard a trumpet blast sound from heaven. And it grew louder and louder and longer until finally, God spoke from heaven. So please keep all of that in mind, because hearing that voice of God speak from heaven, this is what it said. Verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. But in it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, "You speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, and so that you may not sin." So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. Wow! I mean, can you actually imagine being there? Can you actually imagine smelling the smoke, hearing the voice of God speak from heaven, feeling the earthquake under your feet? Ladies and gentlemen, when God came down and revealed himself to Israel at Mount Sinai, his first words were not, so much so, although let me explain in a moment, his first words were not, "Oh, I'm God and I love you so much." Now, he did express his love to them first off, but not in the way that you and I might expect. When God came down and appeared to them on Mount Sinai, he didn't come down in a double rainbow. He didn't come down in a cloud of butterflies. He didn't come down, you know, with you know, little babies, you know, singing or something like that. He came down in a way that was frankly terrifying. And when he spoke, he told them of his love. Look back at it in verse 1. He says, "And the Lord God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Before God commanded them to do anything, he told them of his loving works on their behalf. No, he expressed his love, but you have to admit, he expressed his love in a way that emphasized his authority. And here, God was making a statement to Israel. The statement was very powerful. I am your authority. Israel, Moses is not your ultimate authority. I am, the Lord God said. Israel, you are not your own ultimate authority. No, I, the Lord your God, am. And the whole feeling, the whole sense from here that we sense is that the Lord God was the authority who spoke to Israel from heaven. If you go back to verse 1, just look at it, those words. And God spoke all these words, saying, you know, sometimes we read a little verse like that from the Bible and we trip over and we don't even think about it. Ladies and gentlemen, God, the one who reigns in the heavens, the one who created the heavens and the earth with the word of his mouth, the one who rules and disposes the events of mankind, the one who gave his only son to die on our behalf, that God spoke from heaven. And if God speaks, don't you think you and I should listen? Don't you think you and I should regard the voice of God in a different way that we might regard, let's say, the voice of our own heart? If God speaks, we should regard it in a different way than we might regard the voice of, the democratic voting process. Don't you think that we should regard the voice of God as having more authority than any human ruler, than any human king? It's the voice of God that spoke. And again, I want to emphasize, when Israel heard these commandments come down, God spoke them from heaven to the people. I mean, we saw it right in the verses that I read to you. In verses 18 and 19, after God was finished, what did the people say? Don't speak to us anymore. Moses, why don't you go up on the mountain and you hear from God and tell us what he said? You see, in reading and thinking through these commandments, it's always to be remembered that Israel first heard these commandments audibly spoken by God in a voice from heaven. I don't know what that voice sounded like. I don't think it sounded like James Earl Jones. I don't think it sounded like Charlton Heston. I don't think it sounded like any of those other great readers of the Bible, but it sounded like something that they had never heard before, the audible voice of God from heaven, making the strongest, most authoritative impression upon the people as possible. Now, what did God speak to them? Well, God spoke to them a bunch of laws. Now, you heard me read them in the text that I read to you. And we're not going to go through one by one by one the laws this morning. We're going to save that to the next time we're in the book of Genesis. But the following laws that God gave them were not invented at Mount Sinai. It's not like God was thinking for a few thousand years before the time of Moses, well, what should my laws be? This or that? I don't know. And then finally he made up his mind when they came to Mount Sinai. No. These laws were written in the hearts and minds of men and women even before God ever spoke them at Mount Sinai. I would say to you that from the time of Adam, man had a conscious awareness of at least the principles behind these laws. And why? Because God wrote them into the heart and mind of man because they reflect who God is and we're made in his image. I like what F.B. Meyer said about this. He said, and we'll quote here, "It is wrong to steal or murder or covet, not primarily because these sins are forbidden by the Decalogue. They are forbidden by the Decalogue because they were previously forbidden by conscience. And they are forbidden by conscience because they are forbidden by the nature of things. And the nature of things is God." These commandments begin in the heart, in the mind, in the will of God. They were expressed in the conscience of man made in God's image. And then now at Sinai, they're codified in these Ten Commandments. Now, do you realize what I just told you now is so against the prevailing thinking of the age? The prevailing thinking of the modern age, it's not only in our generation, but a few previous generations as well. The prevailing thinking of the modern age says everybody just makes up their own morality. That there is no universal morality among humankind. Let me tell you, that's a lie. One of the best treatments I've ever read on this is written by the famous author C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Abolition of Man, makes a brilliant argument by looking across cultures, both ancient and modern, and showing that there is a common morality that's properly expressed among men and women. Now look, I'm not trying to say that the morality is common on the fine details. I'll put it to you this way. Some cultures have said that a man can only have one wife. Other cultures have said that a man could have many wives. But no culture has said a man can have any woman he wants. There's been this morality in the culture. And so all have agreed that there's particular obligations to our family, that honesty is good, that things are wrong, and that justice is good. You can't find me a culture where cowardice is declared good and bravery is declared to be bad. Because there are certain things written into the heart of man that are expressed in this morality. So there is a God-based moral code begun in heaven, written in the heart of man, and now here expressed by God at Mount Sinai in these Ten Commandments. And this sets God apart from the commonly worshipped gods of those days. Do you know the commonly worshipped gods of the Egyptians or of the Canaanites or of the Babylonians or the other contemporary cultures? They often themselves were immoral gods, but God gives a moral code revealing it to us in his word that establishes, for example, that the people belong to God and not to Moses. This was not Moses' law. It's funny, as Bible teachers and sometimes writers will commonly refer to that, the law of Moses, Moses' law. You know, it's really sort of a sloppy shorthand because it's not Moses' law at all. It's God's law. And Moses was under the law. Please understand that. Moses was under the law, not over the law. You see, nobody should think of themselves as being above the law. God is above all, and the law is the expression of his will. Therefore, everybody is under the law. This week, I was thinking about this, of course, in preparation for the message. And this week, I've done something that, well, maybe I did a long time ago in school. I can't really remember. Well, let me just say this. It's been a long time since I've broken out the Code of Hammurabi and read it. But I read the Code of Hammurabi this week. It's a famous example of an ancient law code. And many people say, yeah, who cares? The Babylonians under Hammurabi, they had their law code. The Egyptians had their law code. And here's the Israelites. They have their law code. And I'll admit, there's some similarities between them. Matter of fact, the Code of Hammurabi has the famous statement in it, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It says the same thing as the Israelite law code has. But when you look at the differences, the foundational differences are even more dramatic. And you want to know the difference that speaks to me the most pointedly between the Code of Hammurabi and the law that was revealed to us through Moses? It's simply this. If you look at the first many pages, the introduction to the Code of Hammurabi, do you know who it praises? Hammurabi. He's so wonderful. He's the king. He's the one who bestows the law upon the people. The law belongs to Hammurabi because he is the king. He is above the law because he gives the law. Do you understand how different the law of Moses is? Moses is beneath the law because the law is the expression of God's will and God's heart. You see, no man is above the law. Do you realize that this thinking was very much in the heart and the mind of the founding fathers of the United States of America? Matter of fact, and I don't even know if you know this, but both Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin suggested that the great seal of the United States, which you know today is an eagle, their suggestion for the great seal of the United States would be that it depict the scene of Israel coming out of Egypt in the Exodus, including the pillar of fire that led them through the wilderness. They suggested this because they very much saw America as a new Israel, not replacing God's ancient people, but along the same lines that God was bringing them out to a government where the law was above any man, where there wasn't a king who was above the law, but that everybody was equal under the law. Matter of fact, around the perimeter of that seal, they had this statement, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Because that's what they believed. They believed that because the law was greater than any man, when a tyrant disobeyed the law, it was an act of obedience to resist him. Well, this is fascinating. That Moses laid this forth, the importance and the supremacy of God over above any man. But secondly, the fact that God revealed it to Israel and revealed it this way shows us this, that we need this moral law. Do you understand that? We need the moral authority of God to speak from heaven and to instruct us as to what is right and what is wrong. You know, I have to say, what's in my heart and what's in my mind on this topic, I don't know if I can fully express it into words, but this is what I know. I know that the very foundations of our culture are being disrupted. And people no longer, to any great degree, believe that we need to look to God and to his rules, his commands, as an ordering principle for our culture or for our lives. And instead, what we believe is this idea of follow your own heart. Let your own heart tell you what's right and wrong. And ladies and gentlemen, that's not enough. It's not enough for the individual life, and it's not enough for the culture as a whole. We need to know that there's a God in heaven who expects certain moral behavior, and that there's consequences. There's good consequences for obeying those laws, and there's bad consequences for disobeying them. See, the Ten Commandments and all of the law of Moses as a whole gives to us a God-based moral code. It doesn't just tell us that certain behavior is unwise or unhelpful. It tells us this. It says God commands us to do certain things, and it says God tells us not to do other things. And in all of this, the whole implication behind this giving of the law is simply this. Okay, ready? God sees our obedience or our disobedience. Secondly, God measures our obedience or our disobedience. Thirdly, God rewards or punishes our obedience or our disobedience respectively. Now, honestly speaking, how many people do you know who actually live as if those things are true? But if the Ten Commandments are for real, those are foundational principles. And without a God-based moral code, it's difficult or even impossible to answer the question, why, in regard to any moral demand? Do not murder. Why? Do not commit adultery. Why? Do not bear false witness. Why? Let's just take do not steal. Do not steal. Well, why? Because it doesn't belong to you. Yeah, but I want what he has. Well, don't do it because it belongs to him. Yeah, but you know what? He has a lot and I have little, so I want what he has. Do it because you might get caught. I probably won't get caught. Well, don't do it because it's not nice. It's nice to me. Well, don't do it because it's not fair. It's fair to me. How do you answer the why behind do not steal if you can't say that there's a God in heaven who cares about this? The only thing you come back to is whether or not you get caught. And ladies and gentlemen, let's just be honest about this. Just between you and me. Forget about everything, everybody else here. You and I are talking over a cup of coffee right here, right now. You know how it is. In our culture at large, the way many of us think is that the only thing wrong is getting caught. You do whatever you want to do. The only sin is in getting caught for it, not in the actual doing of it. Why do we think this way? Because we've abandoned this idea that there is an objective moral code that we have to answer to from God. You see, this idea of the God-based moral code seems to become less and less popular. And the tendency is increasingly to say, no, I'm not going to have a God-based moral code. I'm going to have a self-based moral code. My moral code is not going to be based in God. It's either going to be based in self or in the culture. I'll let the culture decide and tell me what's right and what's wrong. So if the culture says it's right, well, then it's right. If the culture says it's wrong, it's wrong. Or I'll just look to my own heart. If my own heart tells me it's right, it's right. If my own heart tells me it's wrong, it's wrong. You see, this persistent impulse to make our own moral code is nothing new. I remember this. I don't know why I remember it, but I remember that back in the 1980s, it was the late 80s, 1988 to be example, Ted Turner. Does anybody here remember Ted Turner? I'm not implying that he's dead. It's just he's passed from prominence in the scene. But Ted Turner, he's still around, but he was a great media mogul in the 80s and the 90s. He pretty much made CNN and cable networks what they were. But this man, Ted Turner, he like many successful men, he somehow thought that his area of expertise went far beyond what it actually went. And he thought that, you know, he could really find his calling in life by telling what people should do. So here was his proposal in 1988 at the National Press Club. He released a statement saying, look, let's get rid of the Ten Commandments. Let's replace them with Ted Turner's 10 voluntary initiatives.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. there's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.